When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
There are two rules to remember if you want to have a good time.
Rules! No rules!
Rule number one.
Keep your friends close, but your enemies closer.
Rule number two.
You're a dragon. Be a dragon.
Ciao, Bella.
Today, on a very special episode of Double Dragon, I interview David Peterson. He's the linguist who invented High Valyrian and the guy who writes the dialogue for Rhaenyra and Daemon when they speak High Valyrian in the show. Then I interview medieval historian Kavita Mudon Finn. I also include a short excerpt of my conversation with Ian McInnes. Finally, Steve and I do some listener feedback. We would love for you to leave us a review on iTunes. All right, without further ado, here is linguist extraordinaire David J. Peterson. So I'm with David Peterson. He's the guy. He's the guy behind all of the languages that you've been watching on almost every screen everywhere. Inventor of the linguistic paradigms and a lot of the vocabulary for High Valyrian. The author of a number of books, including The Art of Language Invention. And you've written a children's book called Create Your Own Secret Language. Is that what it's called?
That's right. And it goes from ciphers, so like the very elementary ciphers, up to elementary language creation, and kind of in a step-by-step way.
I've got a child who's maybe just nerdy enough to appreciate that book. I think I'm not shining you on. I think I'm going to purchase this as soon as we're done here. It sounds fantastic. So Macmillan, I'm sure, will have that on the website, and I'm sure you could also buy it from other book vendors, well-known book vendors as well, right?
Wherever they may be, I don't yes. know. Like, you never know who's selling books these days. Sure. Where do you even go to buy a book?
So before we jump into linguistic stuff, I'm just kind of curious, how are you enjoying House of the Dragon?
I'm really liking it so far. For those who are listening at the time of recording, we have cleared episode 3. And I've been enjoying it a lot. I've actually been totally cool with the time skips, which might be jarring a bit for watchers, but I think they're doing a really, really good job with it. The dragons are great. And I'm really appreciating the performances. It's, you know, early days of the season where it's like you're figuring out, who do I really like here?
Yeah, I think that the first episode I was really, I just couldn't take my eyes off Daemon Targaryen. I just thought this guy is stealing every scene he's in. Yeah. And in more recent episodes, I've really come to appreciate a lot of these other actors. You know, King Viserys is just, I mean, I've never seen someone die from a thousand paper cuts so convincingly. He's just amazing. As far as the performance of what that actor is accomplishing, I'm just in awe of what he's been able to do. Do you have a favorite character so far?
I have many. But oddly enough, the one that I keep watching is Viserys 2. Because, you know, especially the first episode, you don't really know what he's all about, because at times he seems like such a marshmallow, kind of like the Robert Baratheon, like, fun time king. It's like, hey, everybody just have a good time, man. We got a kingdom here, and it's for fun. They keep throwing stuff at him. You kind of figure out why he is the way he is.
Yeah.
They give him the opportunity, you know, to really show you how he got to where he is. And also, you know, at times to show his strength and to show you that there is something mm-hmm. else underneath the exterior. And then also times to show you it's like, gosh, all this poor guy really wants to do is just play with his model trains, you know?
Well, he wishes that people would just kind of give him a break. And yeah. it's not like he doesn't think his job's important. He's just so over it. And, you know, he does give the sense of like a CEO who is already looking sideways for some way to get out. He's looking for that golden parachute. But there's none to be had. He's going to have this job till he's dead. So, and it might happen sooner than later because the Iron Throne wants to kill him.
That was a nice little tidbit in episode one. You know, nobody sits easy on the Iron Throne.
Yeah, yeah.
That's always nice to reinforce.
Okay, we've gone past episode one, but I do want to talk about a scene in episode one. It's the scene that kind of hooked me in this show, and it's when Rhaenyra comes in and sees Daemon on the Iron Throne. This sort of this key sacrilege, you know, to for anyone but the king to be sitting on that throne, and for her to kind of look at him almost lovingly and with a bit of admiration because she's a little bit sacrilegious herself. And immediately, they drop into High Valyrian, or they code switch, I suppose, into High Valyrian. And all of the sudden, I'm in. I'm not thinking about anything else. I'm in that world. And it was that code switch that really did it for me. It said so much. It was like shorthand for the world building, in a sense that these two have an elite education. They have a shared history together. They're both, from my view, you can correct me, equal levels of fluent.
Yeah.
And it's almost as if they are reflecting off each other in a way that no other two characters can in the episode. And I just thought it was a brilliant use of this particular language. If you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about that scene, I would love to hear you talk about it.
Essentially, Viserys reminds me of the kind of first generation, first or second generation, basically the one whose parent only spoke, you know, Valyrian maybe.
Mm.
And so now Viserys is this guy who is absolutely fluent in Valyrian, but doesn't want you to know it.
He wants his kids to be able to be fluent in the language of the New World, right?
Yes. And they are, but you can see that with that, they're now kind of like not one step, but two steps removed. There's a lot of like third generation kids who are like, wait a minute, we had this whole cool culture and you basically like didn't give it to us.
Sure.
Why?
Yeah, sure.
Now, of course, they're a little different because they are fluent in High Valyrian. So that's cool. Like evidently that was important enough in their household to maintain so that they actually are fluent. But I mean, culturally, you can see like they are more in tune with it. They're more excited by it than somebody like Viserys, who is like, yeah, 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 I know all that stuff, but you know, we're here now. Let's be focused on being here. And so that's just, I think, a really cool kind of level of detail that was added. So yeah, for that scene, I have to say, you know, when I was, jumping back a little bit, when I was first brought onto the show, I was both delighted and surprised, because I was a part of two other Game of Thrones prequel series.
Interesting.
One of them was the one that produced the pilot, the Blood Moon one. So that was an interesting experience. You know, I got to use my Children of the Forest language. It got abandoned in Game of Thrones. I got to use it. And then they also had me create an Andalish language, because in that setting, the old tongue was going to be represented by English.
And just as a sort of a follow-up question here, did Martin ever give us any Andal vocabulary in any of the works?
Yes. So words like sept, septa, septon.
Okay, this would all be from the Andals. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And so And of course, what it's just very few because modern Andalish is common tongue, which is English in the series. But this was going to flip it because it was going to be the invasion of the Andals. And so they were going to be represented as the foreigners. And so the old tongue was going to be English. And then the Andal language, they had me create one. And so I did. I created a language that basically could have, you know, plausibly, if you evolved it, sound like modern English. It was a lot of fun. And of course, we produced a pilot and then it was canceled. And I never saw it. So
sure.
Somewhere that pilot exists. And I really wonder if it will ever see the light.
It's in the vault.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I worked on it, damn it. I want to see what it was. But,
sure.
So there was that. But then I was also associated with the old Valyria prequel, which would have been set in Valyria before the Doom.
Sure.
And I was brought in at a very, very early stage. This is like before even network drafts, because they were talking about like, well, you know, they're all going to be speaking High Valyrian, so we have to do it in English, but, you know, we still want to use the language. We're coming up with a religion. So like, here are some ideas for gods, you know.
Yeah.
Can you give us input on that? Like, we were going all into it. And then that was canceled like before the stage where you even got to a pilot.
Got it.
But it's like for both of those projects I was involved so early that suddenly I see this announcement from HBO that, like, you know, House of the Dragon is going to be the next prequel. And I'm like, okay.
That's news to me, right?
it's news to me. And not only that, it sounds like it kind of, you know, really features a lot of people that might be speaking Valyrian, and nobody said word one to me.
Right.
And then it's like, it was several months after that, that I finally was contacted and said, I have some Valyrian for you. And I'm like, geez, at this stage, like,
I even talked to you at that stage where it's sort of like, we're pretty sure this is going to happen, but no one's actually contacted the guy that's got to write some of the dialogue here. So anyway.
And so then when I was contacted, and then when I saw the level of dialogue that they were going to have me translate, and I was kind of like, wow, completely unexpected. And so anyway, all this is to build back up to like, this is the first scene. And it's like, you should know that when I got the dialogue, I got it all. I think they had everything but episode 110 done at that point. So I had all the dialogue, but it's like, looking at the first scene, I'm like, this is a significant amount. And so I'm looking at this entire back and forth, and I'm like, my goodness, this entire scene is in High Valyrian. And it's like, you go to like the next episode, she's like, Jesus, look at all this back and forth. And then the episodes that are coming, it's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
So like, that was something that was really quite unique. Because, you know, while High Valyrian enjoyed a lot of use in Game of Thrones, there wasn't a lot of back and forth. It was mainly Daenerys speaking in High Valyrian. Mm-hmm. Other people kind of like speaking in Astapori or Myrnese Valyrian. And then also a lot of back and forth in Dothraki, depending on the season. And so this was giving me a chance to be like, all right, these are people who are fluent in High Valyrian, who each have their own style.
Mm-hmm.
And so who can make their own active choices about how they want to use the language, and will also be used to conversing back and forth in it.
Right. A language almost needs a culture, right? So you almost need someone to speak it with, right? Whereas Dany, like, she would only get rare opportunities to speak it. And I always got the sense that it was, you know, it was quote unquote her mother tongue, but I never got the sense that she was fluent in the way that these characters are. Is that your sense as well?
It's hard to explain it. She would be like, you know, 100% fluent, but not conversational.
Oh, interesting. In maybe it's a reading language for her.
Basically, in the way that, in this way, like when you read something that's been, you know, written. And especially like if you think about like 19th century English for books that were written like that.
Yeah.
They're written, they're fluent, they're written very well. But there's a lot of reflection. It's like on word choice and sentence choice. It's like structured. very beautifully and just so. You don't usually read stuff from that era that's like, hey, what's up? How you doing? It's like, hey, am I? You know, things like that.
Sure.
And so that's kind of like the component she's missing. So where like she's sounds very formal and stilted, and it's kind of interesting because you can see a little bit of that. It's a little bit further removed, but it's like the very highly educated, you know, the masters and so on of Slaver's Bay. I understand High Valyrian, but it's like being lectured by a teacher.
Right. Yeah. I do want to talk about another scene.
Yeah.
All right. It's the scene in the second episode where Rhaenyra shows up dramatically to kind of confront her uncle, who's kind of being an ass. And she basically says that much. She basically gets off the dragon, walks right up to him, and says, what are you going to do about this? Because here I am. She establishes that she knows High Valyrian again, and they have a mutual respect. But then, at a crucial moment, she drops out of High Valyrian, code switches back to the common tongue, and it was almost as if that moment was a key transition because she wants everyone to hear that she has called his bluff. And I just thought, what an excellent use of language in this scene. In a way that brings High Valyrian into the world in a way that enhances it and not just sort of like a garnish or something that's superficial. It's sort of integral to the how that scene works.
It's a kind of power play. You see it with language, but it also features in just different things. It's like, you know, there's also the distinction where it's like you're whispering something to somebody. And then it's like when you see it's not going your way, then you just speak very loudly. So suddenly everybody's looking at you. So it's like you can do the same thing in the same language. But it's like when she's in High Valyrian talking to Daemon, it's like, all right, this is just between us. You know, can we work this out? And then it's like she's all like, you know, so you're having a baby. And he clearly sees it. It's like, well, you know, one day I will. And then she's like, all right, that's it. I said, we're done here.
Okay.
I was going to try to work this out with you. You know?
Yeah. Maybe you could answer this for me. I'm imagining that there are several maesters who will be able to understand High Valyrian. I'm imagining that most Targaryens who are in and around court are some level of fluent with High Valyrian. I'm wondering about someone like Otto Hightower or some of the other folks who are around and listening to the conversation. Like, how many of those people do you think would understand what they're talking about?
That's a good question. The accurate answer is I don't know. But in truth, like, if it were me in court, the best thing that you could do is pretend that it's like, oh, yeah, of course, in my education, I, you know, had a couple of little classes in High Valyrian here and there. And so I don't really speak the language because, in effect, it's to your advantage to be able to understand the language that others are using.
Right. Yeah.
And so it's like with guys like that, it's like if they do understand High Valyrian, they should never tell anybody about it.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. It's advantageous for someone like Otto to be fluent enough to be able to eavesdrop, but also never reveal that he is eavesdropping, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's effectively the same thing that Daenerys does in Storm of Swords, where it's like, basically, Krasnys has given her an advantage, and she recognizes it immediately,
yes,
assuming that she doesn't speak Valyrian, and she's like, why would I betray this? What advantage does this do me if I can understand him and he thinks I don't?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, no, that's a great... I hadn't thought about that, but it's a great analogy here. So I've got a couple questions for you, just about sort of like how the sausage is made a bit. And so let's just start here. Like, what is your relationship with subtitles? Because I think as I've gotten older, I've come to appreciate subtitles a bit more. but it's sort of an interesting choice to use subtitles in a show when you don't have to. And I'm curious about what let's say it's not something that you've written. What's your general feeling about watching a show with subtitles?
When you have a lot of back and forth conversation, like a whole scene in it, you absolutely do need it. I think that there are very clever and very masterful ways to not use subtitles. Just a very small way. I've been watching A League of Their Own, and there's two characters who speak Spanish. And for one of them, at one point, they always subtitle what they're saying. But there's a one point in time where she just starts going off and speaking very quickly, and they don't subtitle it. But you understand what's happening in the context of that scene, and it's actually kind of better if you don't.
Just because of the tone of her voice?
Because of the tone of her voice, the situation. You understand what's going on, and so it's better not to have subtitles for that. Sticking with Spanish, I will tell you that one of the best uses of a lack of subtitles that I've ever seen is in a show called Teen Titans. It's extraordinary. The Teen Titans was the cartoon. It was on Cartoon Network. It had Robin and a bunch of other characters. But there are two characters called Más y Menos, plus and minus, that speak Spanish exclusively. And none of their dialogue is ever subtitled, but it doesn't need to be, because it's done so well with illustrations on screen. You know, it's anime influenced. It's not anime, but it's anime influenced. And so they can do a lot more with expressions and a lot more with, like, kind of fourth wall breaking, like, background illustrations. And so you always understand everything that they're saying, except for, like, you know, a scene where, like, maybe they're arguing with each other and you're not supposed to understand, but you see that they're arguing. So I think it's really, really wonderful for kind of immersive learning.
Yes.
Something like that has to be constructed just so.
Yeah.
It's not many productions that can do something like that. But when it's done, and when it's done well, it's so wonderful.
So, okay. I mean, I just know a little bit of Spanish. I don't know, and I don't know it well enough to be able to say, oh, that was absolutely an error. But every now and again, you'll hear something spoken in Spanish and you'll realize, oh, the subtitle didn't actually match what the person just said. And okay, so
that actually, I mean, that happens in my work too.
Oh, really? Okay. Give me an example of something like that.
I mean, like, it happens all the time. So let's see. Like, you know, it was like, there's this line in episode two where Rhaenyra, and this is the subtitle, you're to have a child.
Sequilat.
Sicagon means to give birth to. Sequilat is like in the future tense, and it's second person plural. And so basically it's like she's saying, you two are going to give birth. And she says to both of them in the same way, it'd be like a couple. It's like, oh, you're having a baby.
Yeah. So you two are expecting is what she's
basically
asking. Yeah.
Basically. And then his response, like one day, it's not actually one day. It's in a day in the future.
Vasilari to me.
And so it's actually much much less of a hedge than he does in English. It's very clear, like when he says you know mazilare to be, it's like I mean, at some point in time we're gonna have a baby.
Yeah, it's possible. Right. Wow. Yeah, no, that's interesting. Yeah. So
and it's like it's just like it comes across a little differently. So it's like you already have a wife. It's like that one's pretty standard. It's just, you know, a wife already you have. His response is not one of my choosing. it's a best way to say that would be like, you know, the way that it, one that I have chosen. No.
Red Dan Lee Dao.
That's fantastic. I love those little details. One last little thing and then I'll let you go. So, sure. All right. I'm imagining that when your process is that you will translate, then you'll record your voice, and then that recording will be delivered to the actors, right?
Yes.
And so they're mimicking you, right?
Yes.
Will they also get sort of a phonetic rendering of these words to make it easy to look at, or do they just see the High Valyrian in the script?
Oh, no. I wouldn't say necessarily a phonetic rendering, but they have syllable by syllable breakdown.
Okay. I was wondering about that. Yeah. Because I would imagine it's no small feat to actually be able to communicate with feeling some of these lines if you don't know which syllables to emphasize.
I will say it this way. I give them more information than they might use. Because every actor's process is different. And so I don't know what will be useful.
Right.
I know that everything that I give has been seen as useful for at least, you know, one actor. And so I'd rather give them more than they need.
Makes sense.
Every so often it's something different. It was really interesting in this, in Dune, Timothée Chalamet, like I always record, at full speed and then slow and then give the English. And he wanted all of his lines just the slow speed and nothing else. It's not like
maybe
it's
he does this with everything. Maybe he like slows down podcasts so everyone sounds like they're drunk. He just prefers it that way.
Yeah, but you know, it's like, you know, it's like, all right, that's what's going to help you. Then great. I'm there for you, you know?
Hey, man, I always appreciate our conversations. I always learn something that's fascinating. And I know my listeners love it too. So I appreciate you coming on.
I am happy to be here. Thanks for having me again.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away. And I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
If you have a question for a real-life medievalist, an expert in the field, you can email those to book@baldmove.com. It might be Kavita that answers the question. It might be one of our other guests. But yeah, if you're watching House of the Dragon and you come up with a question that you'd like to have answered, book@baldmove.com. This is from Devin. Devin writes, in House of the Dragon, we meet a childhood queen who is heir to the throne. From my very limited research, it seems that child kings were sometimes an historical reality. It also seems that queens were sometimes enthroned as rulers, in other words, heads of state. But are there any examples of childhood female heads of state? In other words, do we have any examples of both outliers at once?
We have some very small, rare examples. This tended to not happen very often.
So I'm just going to reframe Devin's question. I think Devin's asking, yeah, we have child kings, and then sometimes we have queens. Would it ever be, do we ever have an example of a young girl as the head of state? I think that's the question.
Yes, it has happened. It is rare. It is extremely rare. And the version that the story that I'm going to bring up, the main reason that I bring it up is because it is very much the direct inspiration, one of the direct inspirations for The Dance of the Dragons. And it is the story of how this went wrong. So the story of Rhaenyra Targaryen is definitely drawing inspiration from a particular period in the 12th century in England that was known as the Anarchy. So you can already tell how well this is going.
Yeah.
So
you've labeled it the Anarchy. This is probably not going to go well.
It's not going to go well. So in the year 1120, there was a shipwreck. And this was known as the Wreck of the White Ship. Normally, ships wrecked in the channel all the time. Would not have been a big deal. Unfortunately, this ship contained the heir to the English throne, William the Eighthling, and his family.
Valuable cargo.
Yeah, valuable cargo. Apparently, everyone was drunk. It was a party ship. They sailed off into the channel and boom, never seen again.
Okay, all right.
So after losing the heir to the throne, Henry II named his only living child his new heir, and this was his daughter, Matilda. And Matilda was at the time married to the Emperor of Germany. She was known as Empress Matilda. And Henry made all of his lords swear fealty to her when she was in her late teens. So she wasn't a child, but she was a teenager. Mm-hmm. But the other thing to keep in mind is she had already been married to the Emperor of Germany. So she already had at least some experience as a ruler, sort of behaving as a
She's a legitimate queen at this point.
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, and she was, and from all accounts, she was actually quite good at it. This happens in and around 1120. Some 15 years later, in the year 1135, Henry died with no other heirs. So he had married again. He tried to have another son, didn't work out. So. Mm-hmm. On the books, de jure, Matilda was still his heir.
Okay.
Unfortunately, when Henry died, Matilda was on the wrong side of the channel. She was in Anjou, in northern France. And Matilda's cousin, Stephen of Blois, who had not as good a claim to the throne, but was also a man, and was also very personable, very charismatic, very good friends with a lot of the local barons. Stephen was persuaded. We don't know how much he wanted it. We don't know how much of this was his plan, how much of this was sort of impulse, but he was persuaded to push his own claim to the throne because his mother was Henry the First's sister.
Okay.
So he had an indirect claim to the throne. Matilda had a direct claim, but Stephen was a guy. So many of the English barons decided to support him and put him on the throne. So Stephen became king. He was crowned at Westminster Abbey in England, all the while Matilda was on the far side of the channel, trying to gain enough support to get over to England and retake her throne. So she started off the war in a disadvantaged position. And part of this, frankly, was her dad's fault, because Henry I, instead of keeping his daughter in England, having her rule at his side, making it basically putting her next to him and sort of putting her in front of his barons over and over and over again. It's like, okay, this is my heir. You have to listen to her. She's going to be directly involved with all of your disputes. Instead of doing something like that, he married her off to someone who was going to improve his short-term prospects in Anjou. Clearly, Henry I believed that he would be able to marry again and have another son. Like, clearly, this was a stopgap measure for him. He did not, we don't know what he was actually thinking at the time, but it seems to me, based on his behavior, that he didn't really expect that she was going to inherit the throne from him. Instead, he was just kind of filling in the gaps until such time as he could have a son. That did not work out for him. So instead, he ended up leaving behind chaos. So Stephen of Blois took the throne. Matilda came in with an army and tried to retake it. She briefly did, and then Stephen kicked her off again. She was captured at one point. There is this absolutely harrowing account of her climbing out the window using sheets, the window of the Tower of London, to escape, like in the middle of winter. Crazy stuff. It's an absolutely wild story. But so Stephen and Matilda both had very strong supporters, and the war was largely a stalemate for a very, very long time. So this war lasted from 1135 to 1154. 1154, Stephen died. Now, Stephen had a son, but his son was, from all accounts, a complete failure at life. Like, just, he was just this terrible kid. Essentially, like, if you want to see Joffrey Baratheon in English history, I believe Stephen's kid might just about qualify. He was apparently just a total piece of work. So Stephen, at this point, had also become very close to his nephew, Matilda's son, at least in part because Stephen had him as a hostage for quite some time.
Okay.
And eventually Stephen decided, you know what, my son is a loser, and I am probably going to see if I can end this war by leaving the throne to Matilda's son. While Stephen and Matilda themselves never actually resolved their issues, in the end, Matilda withdrew her claim to the throne in favor of her sons. And Stephen, when he died in 1154, left the throne to Matilda's son, who became Henry II, who is known perhaps also as Eleanor of Aquitaine's husband. So that is how all of that came about. And that may also explain why Henry II was such an aggressively hands-on king, because he had witnessed firsthand the damage that can be done when you are not careful with your aristocrats.
Sure. Yeah, and, you know, it's, of course, there's certainly some House of the Dragon DNA in this story. You know, it's not an exact fit, but, there's a few key players in that historical episode that could have easily been the inspiration for sort of the early days of the House of the Dragon situation.
Absolutely. Yeah, much like the main story in A Song of Ice and Fire it's clearly got its roots in the Wars of the Roses. I mean, just York, Lancaster, Stark, Lannister, like the whole thing is right there. But obviously what George R. R. Martin is doing is he's taking these stories and then he's kind of running off in different directions with it. And with the House of the Dragon, with the Dance of the Dragons, obviously the biggest difference is that these are not just people who are fighting with swords and shields on horseback. They have enormous fire-breathing dragons that can wreak absolutely catastrophic damage on everything that they encounter. So,
we're supposed to imagine the narratives of the medieval period taking place in addition to weapons of mass destruction. So it's a little bit, you know, of course.
It's a lot.
it's a lot to deal with.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is reward unto itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
This is a question from Jeremy. In the Ice and Fire universe, there are swordsmen of great renown. Very often we'll hear tell of, like, the greatest swordsman I ever saw, or similar legends about allies told by enemies. In France or England or Scotland, etc., are there similar legends of actual warriors who became legendary?
Yes, and I think what's interesting is that these things are discussed in our medieval sources. So medieval chroniclers often made reference to the Nine Worthies, when they were discussing their heroes. And this is a list of mythical and ancient historical figures who were held up as being, you know, the exceptional examples of warriors. So it included figures like Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar, King Arthur and Charlemagne. Mm. And so they would compare the heroes of their day to those classic figures. And that's often, you know, made quite a lot of. You get examples of particular knights and warriors who are held up as being exceptional. So one is the English knight Sir Giles d'Argenton. He was a crusader and a famous knight who Edward II specifically recruited to be part of his bodyguard for the campaign that led to the Battle of Bannockburn in 1314.
Again, the name of the knight is Sir Giles
d'Argenton.
D'Argenton. All right. Thanks.
Yes. And he does his job. He as the battle is going against the English, he helps escort Edward II from the battlefield. But his honour won't let him leave while the battle is still ongoing. So he sends the king on his way, and then he charges back into the thick of the action, and is killed. And Scottish sources, you know, writing about, you know, what is an enemy knight, Scottish sources say that he was one of the three greatest knights in Christendom at that time, alongside the Holy Roman Emperor and perhaps unsurprisingly King Robert I of Scotland.
Let me just ask you this, because I'm a little bit of a cynic when it comes to these things. So is it that he's the greatest knight, or is that he saved a king's life and so the king is going to make sure that they're, you know, that his reputation lives on? Whereas there may be, you know, better warriors out there, but they never saved a king, you know?
I mean, I think that would be the case if our only source for it were English sources, and you could then see that it was kind of reflective of maybe a propaganda campaign. But I think it's interesting that you get Scottish writers saying the same.
Interesting.
Which seems to then suggest that you get that reflection of that writers in the time can recognize idealized forms of behavior, even exhibited by members of the enemy, if it's done for the right reasons, if it's done well, if it's bravery and what have you, then they still recognize that, even if it's an enemy warrior that's doing it. So I think that does seem to suggest it's something that A, that happened, but also B, that it was something that generated quite a lot of buzz at the time, and that people recognized that as a warrior sacrifice almost.
And you were going to mention another knight or another warrior too before I interrupted you.
No, sorry. Yeah, I think that there are other ones that become famous. Back to your point, there are other ones that become famous because they are written about, and they have romances or poems or songs written about them that have come down to us. So you have knights like the English knight William the Marshal. He had a storied career in the service of the various later 12th century English kings. He fights a lot in tournaments. He has a great reputation as a young knight, as a tournament knight. He doesn't take part in very many battles, but does participate in a lot of sieges. But his career as a chivalric warrior is celebrated in the history that's written about his life, after probably in the years just after his death. And so that very much celebrates and records his life and saves it for posterity and also for young knights to show them what a knight should be.
Hmm.
And then later on, you get the French example of Bertrand de Guesclin, French hero of the Hundred Years' War. He's similarly written about in verse form, which celebrates his life and his military achievements. And indeed, that poem suggests that he should be listed as a 10th worthy. So that idea that he should join the pantheon of the 9 worthies and be added to that list of heroic figures.
Let me ask you this question. I do get the sense that anytime you travel, it's kind of dangerous business. There could just be bandits along the road. And I mean, I guess that's maybe one of the reasons that you would need a knight nearby, just to protect the innocent, I suppose. Was it equally dangerous to travel by sea because of, I don't know, piracy or just, you know, people that were stronger and had bigger ships picking on people who were less powerful that had, I guess the question is, which would have been more dangerous in terms of robbers and bandits to travel by land or sea?
Possibly more by land, to be honest. I think, I mean, you would try to arm yourself with means of protection, usually, you know, a safe conduct from the king to travel through their territory. But yes, if you're abandoned, that's not going to be worth the paper it's written on. Although, of course, if you're caught as a bandit, then you can also be executed for breaking the king's law.
Right.
But yes, I think, you know, travel by sea, yes, there is the chance of piracy. You know, there are plenty of pirates working independently or indeed sometimes for kings and countries in the Middle Ages, in like the North Sea and in the Baltic region. I mean, in the Mediterranean, you have issues of North African piracy as well, which you have to be careful of. But I mean, sea travel is dangerous. Sea travel is more dangerous for other factors.
Oh, just, yeah, sure.
You know, weather. And the fact that you have to largely follow the coastline means that any bad weather is likely to blow you onto the cliffs or onto the coast.
Yeah.
And there's the danger of just capsizing and sinking. There's also the danger of where you wash up. The locals might just try to rob your cargo anyway. And you know, all manner of nasty things happen to ship's crews that get washed up on foreign shores.
So my son and I were like doing voices to each other the other day, and I broke into a Macho Man Randy Savage voice, and he's like, "Wow, you do that really well," which is a high compliment. You know, you whenever you get a compliment from your 15-year-old son, it's kind of a big deal, right? But when he compliments you on how well you're doing Macho Man, it's like, yeah, it might be the highlight of the month.
So I think that like, Macho Man is the Gen X impersonation equivalent to the Boomer Pacino.
That works. That actually really works.
There's nuance to Macho Man, right? I mean, like, you do a Macho Man, pretty much everybody gets it. But I love that when Macho Man is not, like, getting super excited and, like, the cellophane sunglasses aren't off yet.
Oh, you gotta love Macho Man when he's like a super low decibel,
right? And he's completely riffing. It's just like freeform jazz, and you know he's off script. He's at some point he's just trying to rile up the bass, but he's just "Will you tell your engine?" It's sensual. So, in a way.
Yeah, no, it is. It's very sensual. Now, I showed my son a couple YouTube videos of Macho Man. Not him wrestling, but him being interviewed by Mean Gene.
Yeah. And there, poetry.
There was this great, he had this little bit where he was like a prop comic. He came in, he was like, "Oh yeah, I'm calling the cream of the crop. I'm the cream of the crop." He kept on calling himself the cream. And then he pulled out a little like tub of creamer that you would get at a diner. And he had it, and he was holding it up for like a visual aid about, like in case you forgot what cream is.
Like when Chad Johnson would pull the Sharpie out, you know, and sign the football after. Sure. And that's amazing.
So then he holds it up, and he's like, you know, like doing 360s, is kind of spinning as he talks. And then he puts the creamer on top of his head and balances it there as if he's like going to show he's got amazing balance, and it immediately falls off his head. But he's got another creamer his other pocket.
Backup creamer, dude.
It's just genius. It's like I'm watching performance art. I mean, that's the thing. It's like to be an amazing performer in the ring, but to be even more amazing as an interview.
It was him versus the universe, and the universe is bringing gravity to a creamer fight, and we're not prepared.
Oh my gosh. We will never see his kind again.
Oh man, no way. No way. I mean, I remember being vexed at the time. Because I'm like, I don't know, is this an accent?
Well,
is
first of all, is this an impediment? He was amazing in that you're kind of like not sure if he's got a full deck of cards, but
right.
Miss Elizabeth, she looks like she's got it together. You know, she's a very beautiful woman. She seems like she's aside from the fact that she's following this guy around.
I can fix him.
And he's one of the only guys that has sort of a woman that looks like she's got together in his corner. And so it almost brings him a bit of credibility. It's like, well, if she is into him,
right,
maybe there's something more here.
Right. At first, you're like, maybe, like, at first glance, like, is that his niece? is she, like, his handler, like, helps him get from place to place? Because in Macho Man had that, like, is he old? That kind of quality to him, like, mm-hmm. always. Like, he had Huey Lewis syndrome.
Yes, he was the Huey Lewis of... But they all kind of did. It's like Honky Tonk. How old was Honky Tonk? Honky Tonk seemed like he could have been 20 or 60.
Right, yeah. Yeah, Big Boss Man was somewhere in the mid-30s to already dead.
I never knew Hulk Hogan who wasn't bald. I mean, to be the best, he was the best, right? He was the best for a good decade. But he was clearly bald.
Yeah, and I think that's what made, like, Ultimate Warrior is so menacing, because I'm like, full head of hair.
That guy's got a full head of hair.
He's, like, his muscles have muscles. He's jacked beyond belief.
Yeah, but it was the hair. His hair had hair.
Yeah, and it was the first time I think we really got to see, like, oh, like, I don't think these guys are in as good a shape as we thought. Like, that's kind of that, you know, until the Ultimate Warrior shows up.
Yeah, when Ultimate Warrior shows up, you're almost like, yeah, this big flourish at the end by Hulk Hogan where he, like, put his boot to someone's face.
Right.
Not that impressive. It's not an elevator slam, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, the Ultimate Warrior was one of those first, like, moments when I think all of our sexuality was challenged, right? Like, I think we were just sort of in a rut, you know, we just sort of, we thought we, you know, we knew what we'd loved.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came in and kind of upset the whole thing. Like, wait, I mean, I was not prepared to, like, have a new favorite. So, like, the tension between, you know, I think the audience and Ultimate Warrior was very palpable.
Mm-hmm. Well, you weren't sure whether he was a good guy or a bad guy for a while.
Right. And somehow, even when the makeup would, like, mostly fall off his face, I still had no idea what his face looked like.
No, if I met Ultimate Warrior, he was, like, a really important figure in my life. It was like, you know, my pastor and Jesus and Ultimate Warrior. But if I met him on the street, I couldn't tell you. I wouldn't be able to tell you.
If the Ultimate Warrior sans makeup, still full hair, and, like, if in a suit or something, mugged me, there's no way I would be able to describe.
You know, I'm always sort of a little bit critical of people that don't recognize Batman without the cowl.
Right.
It's totally Ultimate Warrior for me. Like, I have no idea what he would look like without the face paint. Yeah.
If he came in with glasses on, I'd be like, ooh, what?
if he pulled the Clark Kent.
Right.
He was actually Mean Gene Okerlund.
It could have been. I mean, I'm not... there's no telling.
Did we ever see those two together at the same time?
I don't know.
Steve, did you know that in the category of TV reviews, we are the second highest ranked podcast in the Philippines?
Is that right?
Yeah. We've jumped almost 50 ranks in the last week to become the second highest ranked television review podcast in the entire nation of the Philippines.
Entire nation of the Philippines. Wow, it's nice to know what our demo is, you know.
Yeah, so to all of our friends in the Philippines, I'd like to say kamusta po, and we'd love to know what it would take to be number one.
Right. Yeah, is it lumpia references? Because I got them.
We could do a whole podcast review of Philippines cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
That would not require me to learn any more than that one phrase that I just tried and probably failed.
Right. Yeah, no.
But, you know, it's nice. It's nice that we're loved in the Philippines, but I would like to be number one. I would like to know. I would like to know from our Philippines listeners, what would it take for us to become number one?
And so what is number one?
They don't tell me. They send me these rankings by way of email.
Interesting.
And so it looks like we're number two. We're also very high. We're number four in Finland and number five in Hungary.
Well, Finland makes sense because I had a pen pal in fourth grade.
That's right. I forgot what your pen pal.
From in Finland. And I like, he wrote me all the time. And I think I wrote him once, maybe twice. And it was like, you know, like, he's asking all these questions about America, and I'm answering them and asking no questions about Finland. Like, I just, I was
way
just
to
like,
represent. Let it be, yeah, an ambassador.
I mean, well, I mean, let's not pretend we, like, when Joe Biden says, this is not who we are, it's like, kind of.
It's not who we are. People.
When he's sending, when he's asking, like, you know, all the right questions, and you know, and rather than reciprocate, I'd be like, my teacher's a real drag, or what, you know, just dumb stuff, you know, like, I watched this today, you know, Jack Tripper was hilarious, you know, whatever. And and so that's, so I'm wondering if, like, in all this time.
Now, what was his name? Do you remember his name? You probably don't.
Good Lord, no.
Well, I'm asking because we
I'm not even positive it was Finland at this point.
I'm asking because we did get some a listener email from Finland, which I will read.
I can't wait. It's going to be like whatever it took to finally hear your voice.
Now, it could be your pen pal. I'm not sure, but it is Misa. Was it Misa? Was your pen
pal? No, I would have remembered Misa.
All right. So Misa writes, "Hi, guys. I just want to let you know that Steve has just quite possibly become my favorite person. He has been on the list of contenders for ages, and finally finding out that he agrees with me on the Game of Thrones final season and episodes tipped him into the lead."
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So you're just killing it in Finland.
It's redemption.
I'm going to assume that the Philippines listeners are tuning in for me. For some reason, you're really popular in Finland.
Yeah, I'm trying to hold. I got Finland on lock. I'm thinking, you know, going back to the Philippines thing, like, what does it take to get the number one? We got to just find out who's number one and take them out.
Yeah,
it's about market share.
Yeah,
right. I mean, we could try to grow our product, or we could try to eliminate the other. Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna
when I say eliminate, I'm not.
Let's just assume that it's Aaron and Jim.
Oh,
I know at least where Aaron lives, and I could make that happen. Pretty sure I can
That's,
make that happen.
And the thing is, when I say take them out, like, I mean, I don't mean, like, you know, murder them.
Oh,
I
you're going, like, to have to be more specific. I'm Italian.
Yeah. I mean, like, just they can't talk anymore.
Oh,
like, that
so
would
you
help.
you just want a trachea to be destroyed.
I don't want to know the details. The less I know, the better. I'm just giving broad brushstrokes here. Okay. You do the detail work.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And we don't care how long we're number one. We just want to know that we have been number one. So maybe I could just, like, punch Aaron in the throat 1 week.
Mm-hmm.
That would eliminate his ability to podcast for a week or two. And it would create some space for us.
Like, I'm not saying drop a safe on him. But I'm saying if you dropped a safe near him, like, that would kind of shake him, right? Mm-hmm. He might just have to take a week off. You know, it'd just be like, hey, I was too close. I need to really rethink, you know, maybe he'll go to, like, a cabin or go to the mountains or something, just to sort of, like, to unplug or disengage for a while. Like, that's all. A good scare.
This is a very sort of half measure on your part.
Well, the thing is, I mean, like, and again, I'm not saying drop a safe on him, but, like, when you drop a safe near him, I mean, he could zag. And then that was it. And then now number one is ours for a while.
Yeah, and maybe we could take hold, you know. Maybe once we have the spot, we could, you know, try to actually cover the show with a little bit more depth and not talk about things like maggot bowls and people's haircuts and things like that.
Oh. Unless that's what's moving the needle.
Unless that's what's doing it. Unless that's what's doing it. I do have another email to read. This is from Kristen. She says, "I move that the opening theme song of House of the Dragon be changed from its current iteration to add Steve and Anthony singing Peter Dinklage over and over during the opening credits." I think we could make this happen.
Yeah.
"The fact that Peter Dinklage does not appear in House of the Dragon should not be considered an obstacle to this proposal, because the Peter Dinklage song is at least as awesome as the Ed Sheeran song sang in Game of Thrones." Love Electric Boogaloo and Double Dragon. Keep up the good work. So thank you, Kristen. We could either superimpose the Peter Dinklage song and the opening credits, or Steve and I could just sing it to each other every episode. Those are two options that I've come up with just on the fly here.
What if you could get Peter Dinklage
to help us sing the song?
Yeah.
Oh, geez. Yeah, that would be quite something, wouldn't it?
That would be something. Or if we could get like maybe like a Peter Dinklage lookalike.
We could do like a Dinklage
Silver Spoons. So like when Silver Spoons, when Alfonso had the fake Michael Jackson for his birthday. Yeah.
Now, but it was the real Menudo, I think.
Yeah, the real Menudo. There was a whole thing about, like, I think Ricky lied about getting Menudo. Yeah. And then somehow, did Richard have connections to Menudo?
I think, well, I do remember, you know, rich people know other rich people, but I do remember that there was at one point a case of mistaken identity because one of the band members of Menudo was named Ricky.
Oh, is that what it was? Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Then the wannabe girlfriend or followed him instead. I rewatched the Menudo scene from Silver Spoons a lot. It's the thing about me that I don't know if this is going to hurt our Finland rep or not, but I mean it's one of the all time, because like I'll get the song in my head and I think I know what the song is and I just don't. And so I'll just kind of make noises instead of actually singing the lyrics.
So you look it up?
Yeah. And I think it's called like keep on moving or something. But and I'll just sort of just do nonsense words anyway.
Yeah, I think that, sorry, Kristen, I think we're going to go ahead and call an audible here. We are not going to do the Peter Dinklage song. I think it's going to be us singing Menudo. But we're not going to be singing the actual lyrics. We're going to be singing nonsense lyrics.
Yeah, just my nonsense
and,
words.
We'll do our best. We'll do our best. Okay. We do have a couple iTunes reviews, and we love to get iTunes reviews. It helps people find us. And if we are ever going to overtake the fine folks who are number one in the Philippines, I think we're going to need some more folks writing us reviews on iTunes.
It'd be even better if they were, like, if it's not another House of Dragon, but it's, like, something maybe, like, more specific to the Philippines, which means that, like, we've really cracked into their, you know, into their whole... Oh, absolutely.
I was just assuming, it's probably some, like, the top show in the Philippines... has a dedicated podcast, and they're always going to be number one, unless we do something about it. Which I'm doing my best to do something about it right now. Okay, so this is the kind of review that if you're listening from the Philippines, this is the kind of review that we would love to hear from you. This is called Bedtime, and Robin and Elliot writes, I sometimes listen to this podcast while falling asleep. Take from that what you will. ... Are you right? I hear your keyboard. Are you writing a review for us right now?
That's right. I'm going to Google Translate, and I'm trying to.
So this person says he listens to us while he falls asleep. He or she or they fall asleep with us. Piping into their ear holes. Do you feel like maybe we should be doing more lullabies on Double Dragon?
Well, I think we're nailing it is what I'm gathering from this. We are, even if they're bored and they find us boring enough to go to sleep, they obviously need their sleep and they're appreciative.
Or maybe they're trying not to fall asleep. Maybe they're at work. Oh. And they put us on to stay awake and we are failing every time.
We're failing. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it could be our dulcet tones that are very soothing and what you need as you go to sleep and you absorb all of our knowledge as you're sleeping and we infiltrate your dreams, sort of like a sweet Freddy Krueger.
This is a review from Brian. He writes, good stuff, 5 stars. Funny stuff, thorough, great academic guests. Probably the best Game of Thrones and Dragon Huts show out there. Thanks for the effort. Dragon Huts. I guess this is shortened form of House of the Dragon, but it does sound a little bit like a fast food franchise.
Sounds delicious. Dragon Hut.
Yeah, we were talking before about like a dragon egg burrito, like breakfast burrito. Mm-hmm. I think that would be at least one of the items featured at Dragon Huts.
Yeah, their breakfast menu for sure. You'll probably get, I'm assuming everything's flame broiled.
Everything's flame. Yeah, very good, very good. Serve, honey wine. Probably have to serve some honey wine.
So you're thinking sort of like a fast food version of medieval times. Is that what we're looking at?
I guess that's what I was thinking, yeah. Something like that.
Now, is this Targaryen themed? Is it a family business?
I mean, I think that there's probably different meals should feature different parts of the kingdom. Because I think that, people would like, Sansa was really into lemon tarts. I think we could definitely do lemon tarts for sort of our northern cuisine.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could have like reek sausages.
I think we're done. I'd like to apologize to all the folks of the Philippines.
Thank you.